Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Today on Truth and Movies, Sam Mendes goes over the top in the immersive First World War drama 1917.
You have a brother in the 2nd Battalion.
Yes, sir.
They're walking into a trap. Your orders are to deliver a message calling off tomorrow morning's attack. If you fail, it will be a massacre.
Taika Waititi directs the Hitler youthful coming-of-age comedy Jojo Rabbit.
Did you know Jews can read each other's minds?
But how would you know if you saw one? They could look just like us.
Hi.
The tramp takes a shot at the Führer in Charlie Chaplin's The Great Dictator.
By a strange trick of fate, the ruthless dictator and Charlie resemble each other like two peas in a pod. Except that while Adenoid Hinkle makes millions of people tremble, Charlie makes them die. Of laughter.
All coming up in Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. Hello there, movie truthers. Happy New Year. Welcome to 2020. It's Michael Leader here, sitting in the host chair, sitting across this week from Adam Woodward.
Hiya.
And Hannah Woodhead.
Hello.
How are we both doing? How are we all doing?
Very well, yeah. Suitably rested and watched a lot of movies over the holiday season, mm-hmm. So yeah.
And so many movies coming.
So many.
This
Too
is
many.
That awards corridor, isn't it, where we're getting big hitters every week, right?
Yeah. We have the sort of benefit of being sent stacks of award screeners when all the voting, I guess, is happening. So I've got into that point of just basically not knowing when anything's actually coming out and forgetting that something already, like Jojo Rabbit, is in cinemas now, and we've sort of forgot to cover it before. So, but it feels like a film that's been coming out for ages, right? Because Hannah, you saw it in like Toronto or something, and then there's other films which aren't out until much later, like April or something, which I've still got screeners for. So it's a bit of weird.
And films like Parasite, which everyone's talking about right now, which is coming out in February.
It's I mean, the a crazy time of Parasite's year. Been so long, and Portrait of a Lady as well, because we saw those at Cannes in May, and obviously they're coming out like basically 10 months later, which I get it, but it does mean we're sort of sadly a bit removed. But, you know, I'm happy that good movies are getting recognition and some good, some not so good movies are getting recognition.
It's
as well.
A very discombobulating time of year. But before we dip into 2020's new releases, we do have some, we have a matter to attend to from last year's films. A film that actually didn't do very well at the box office over the Christmas break was Cats. But we got a letter from Helen McGrath who says here, I was listening recently to your Cats review. I've not seen the film, but on the Bovril sign, if listeners may remember, we talked about how it was very conspicuous that one of the neon lights up there in Cats London was Bovril. Wouldn't that just be to mark the area of Piccadilly Circus as opposed to any incongruous product placement? For years, there was famously a massive Bovril sign up at Piccadilly Circus, see attached pic. And Helen attaches a pic here where it has a big Bovril sign. It's definitely Piccadilly Circus. With also Wrigley's and a big sign saying Guinness is good for you.
Well, I'm happy that Tom Hooper got one thing right. You know, there was a lot wrong with that film, but no one could accuse him of not knowing where the big Bovril sign was.
Well, I think I will accuse him of not knowing where the big Bovril sign was, because I think in the film it's in Trafalgar Square. not Piccadilly Circus, which this picture shows.
So he still managed to mess it up, honestly.
I don't know. The thing we were getting at was just how absurd it was that all other neon signs,
yeah,
all other theatre marquees had puns around cats.
Not Bovril.
And then Bovril. There's something there. There's some deep in-joke that we're not getting.
I don't know. Maybe they were simultaneously trying to be accurate to historical London and get in the pocket of Big Bovril.
Big Bovril. That
film's not made any money, so maybe, like, the Bovril money is going to tide them over. I don't know. I
mean, they were given a blank check by Bovril.
I do think it we've had quite a lot of feedback about that podcast. Very good, actually, for the general kind of emails we get. But a lot of people were like, actually, I think you'll find the Bovril. And I was like, why does everyone know about this Bovril sign apart from me? Is this, like, part of when you are born in London, you kind of, well, yes, and here's the big book of Bovril for you, for your baby? Because I only moved here 5 years ago and I didn't have any idea about this Bovril business. Well, you know, you learn something new every day. Thanks, Helen.
Thank you so much, Helen.
Genuinely, that's the kind of trivia I love. So if everyone's got any more trivia for us,
please do send them in.
On the box office flop, mm-hmm, that was Cats, I read a really interesting piece. I think it's on Forbes this week, just really dissecting why the film failed commercially, and it's really interesting. It sort of dives into how much of an anomaly this is for this kind of big, you know, award season baiting star-studded movie to actually not just like underperform, but basically it's not going to make anywhere near its budget back. So really a really interesting read if anyone's interested in that sort of stuff.
Our good friend the Safdie brothers, Uncut Gems, released over Christmas in the United States and made more money than Cats at the box office, which I think is pretty incredible for an independent film that won't have gone on anywhere near as many screens as Cats did.
They should have got Adam Sandler to be the magical Mr. Mistopheles.
He's my jellical choice.
But that's a good segue, Hannah, because, of course, we're big fans of the Safdie brothers on this show. We had an interview special that went out over the Christmas break with the two brothers. And also, this Thursday, we're having the screening of Daddy Longlegs, one of their early features.
We are, yeah. Their first feature they directed together will be down at the Prince Charles. We will be watching it, but we will also be hosting a live episode of Truth and Movies. You, me and our good boy David Jenkins, and we'll be talking about Daddy Longlegs and Uncut Gems, so come on down. We've got some signed Uncut Gems posters to give away as well, so it's well worth staying in your seat after the film finishes. It's only a 100-minute movie, so it's not like a long one.
It's going to be a late live show, though.
It is. It's going to be a Truth of Movies after dark. We're going to get some soft jazz playing, us all a whiskey, you know. Have that energy into 2020. But I mean, I know anyone that has been listening to this podcast or indeed following our Twitter will have probably noticed my merciless campaign about Uncut Gems. But I do think if you're going to watch Uncut Gems, or if you've seen Uncut Gems, you'll get a lot out of watching Daddy Longlegs. I think you can definitely trace the lineage. So I highly recommend it. Even if you don't come to screening, just go and watch it. It's a great movie.
And if you are interested, please do come along to that screening, especially if you're free and around in London near the Prince Charles Cinema on Thursday the 9th of January. That's today. Tickets at their website.
Yeah, 8:45 p.m.
Before we crack on with new release reviews, Adam, any other business from the White Lies Towers?
Well, just to tease that we've got a new issue coming out. Put to bed just before Christmas. Hitting shops, hitting newsstands this week. We're going to be making an announcement about that on Thursday as well. And David, I think, is on next week, so he'll talk a bit more about the issue and what to expect from it. But yeah, look out for that announcement.
Ah, brilliant. Anyway, we should crack on with this World War special. We're going to be covering both World Wars here in our new releases this week. Up first, starting appropriately with the First World War in 1917. At the height of the First World War, two young British soldiers are given a seemingly impossible mission. In a race against time, they must cross enemy territory and deliver a message that will stop a deadly ambush on thousands of British soldiers. Let's hear a clip.
You have a brother in the 2nd Battalion?
Yes, sir.
They're walking into a trap. Your orders are to deliver a message calling off tomorrow morning's attack. If you fail, it will be a massacre.
We've got orders to cross here.
That is the German front line.
Hold back!
If we're not clever about this, no one will get to your brother.
I will.
So, Adam, 1917. This sort of came out of nowhere. Halfway through last year, we heard that Sam Mendes was putting together this First World War thriller, spectacular thriller. Roger Deakins doing cinematography. Something about it being almost shot in one continuous take. Mm. How's it turn out?
Yeah, I guess we should tackle the one take aspect of this film first and foremost, because I'm not really sure where that came from. I'd heard about the film towards, I think, the middle of last year, when there was talk about them shooting it, and then suddenly the trailer, I think, just dropped. Mm-hmm. Suddenly you're like, wow, they've kind of made this film, and it seemed like quite a big thing, especially for a director like Sam Mendes, who directed the last two James Bond films and is generally quite, I don't think, well regarded in sort of British cinema. And yeah, I'm not sure whether that came out of his camp and that was a PR message that kind of got misconstrued slightly, the whole one-shot thing. Mm. But really the film, I think, is more accurate to describe it as taking place in real time.
Right.
So it takes place over essentially 24 hours, and there's quite a nice symmetry to the narrative. Mm-hmm. We should say it's very light on plot. It is, if you do like more action from your war films, then this probably is one for you, because it does kind of throw you straight into the action, and it's pretty relentless as well once mm-hmm. it gets going. I think the first scene, when the two young privates are given their mission and they have to initially leave the trenches and cross over no man's land, just that sequence is one of the most nerve-wracking and immersive sequences I've seen in any war film, I think. It's wonderfully shot by Roger Deakins on cinematography duties. Just the actual, not just the technical aspect of how they filmed it in a continuous take, or to feel like it's a continuous take, but actually the logistics and the mechanics of how they follow the two actors, because they're essentially sliding through mud and stepping over kind of dead bodies and horses and all sorts. And I was just watching it thinking, how are they actually filming this? It's quite amazing. And they're obviously using like steady cams. It was shot digitally as well, which obviously enables them to make it feel like a one take thing. It's a little bit of a shame that they stick with that. I think using that technique, using that formal bit of showmanship initially works really well, immerses you in the film. I think the longer the film goes on, the more this whole mechanic actually is a bit of a roadblock for the immersiveness that is supposed to be engendered by mm-hmm. it. So, yeah, it just kind of gets to a point where it becomes a little bit boring, actually. I think it's one of those films where it shows the value of a good cut and a good editor. I bet the actual editor, I mean, I'm not sure how this film was edited, mm-hmm. essentially, whether there was like multiple takes ultimately stitched together, much like Birdman mm-hmm. in recent years, and famously Alfred Hitchcock's Rope. There's a little bit of like effects work going on here, like little cuts hidden in the shadows and things like that, so you can kind of look out for them. And we should say as well, there's one really hard cut in the middle of the film, which essentially separates it from like Night and Day. But yeah, it just really left me feeling like this is a film probably needed an editor, needed some cuts, because cuts can release tension as much as they can build it, right, if used correctly. So I think it sort of puts itself into a corner a little bit, this film, which it can't really get out of.
I'm going to invoke the D word quite early in this segment, Dunkirk, mm. and it feels like that long take approach is Sam Mendes' way of differentiating this film from what Christopher Nolan did in Dunkirk, which is the exact opposite, right? With cutting back and forth and multiple timelines and multiple threads. So having this play out in real time. What I think differentiates this in a good way, particularly early on in the film, is the fact that it takes place towards the end of the First World War. Mm. Everyone is really beaten down by this long slog of a war. And part of the setup is the German line has retreated and they're crossing into no man's land, former enemy territory that's been deserted. So there's so much tension and suspense in these early scenes of just open agoraphobia inducing space with no one around. It's the complete opposite of Dunkirk, which really did, you know, beat you into submission mm. with the tension of another flyby. But yeah, maybe it doesn't sustain that all the way through. Hannah, what did you make of 1917? Was this your sort of jam?
I'm not like a huge war movies person. I didn't really like Dunkirk. I thought it was okay. I wasn't really sold on it as much as everyone else. I like George Mackay, so I was quite excited to see him do his thing. And I think it's kind of interesting how the film sets him up basically as the initially, at least, you feel like he's kind of not really the lead character, and then a thing happens, and it very much becomes this. You know, he's completely on his own, both physically and mentally. He's very kind of, like you saying, very worn down and beaten by this relentless war. And I think it's getting that sense of kind of how desperate it was towards the end of the war is really what I wouldn't say I enjoyed it, but I think was the most interesting thing. You know, the way that the soldiers are sort of skin and bone. Everyone, like all their commanders are just in pieces. There's a lovely Andrew Scott scene in this, Hot Priest of Fleabag fame, where he's only on the screen for about 2 minutes.
Hot Sergeant.
But he's just kind of so withering and disinterested in the very, very important mission that George Mackay and Dean Charles Chapman have. Mm-hmm. And he's just like, do what you want. I don't care anymore. We're all going to die, which I very much enjoyed that. There's a real sense that all the kind of supporting players in this have their own storyline going on in tandem to the actual storyline, which I liked, because when you've got kind of these big hit, there are a lot of very famous people in this for about 2 minutes at a time.
Could I suggest, there's not much to spoil in this film, but if anyone's interested in seeing this film and they don't know who's in this, I suggest playing a game of guess the cameo.
Yeah.
Because you can almost think, okay, what sort of middle-aged, or just not a middle-aged, bit older, what sort of actor would play the general? What sort of actor would play a sergeant, a lieutenant? And you can probably guess who's going to be in this film.
I was really hoping that Stephen Fry would pop up in sort of Blackadder guise at some point, and sadly he doesn't.
No Fry, no Fewless. Yeah. Opportunities were missed.
But it's interesting how it sort of follows a loose video game structure as well. So they're on this like bigger mission, but each it's sort of chaptered slightly. So you have different locations, even though you're following these guys... and that there isn't really like a break in terms of the continuity of the geography. There are very distinct, I think, little chapters and missions, submissions almost within the film. And it's like you get to a point where a stalwart British character actor comes in.
Checkpoint.
It is like a checkpoint. And it's like a little cutscene that happens in the movie. I don't know whether that was intentional. I feel like Sam Mendes maybe isn't a big video game guy. But
I'd love to know, because this... I'd go so far as to say I wish this was a video game instead of a film. The fact that that real-time aspect really does lend itself to feeling like you're playing a video game or watching a Let's Play video game.
It's like watching someone else play a video game.
But then also... the aesthetic is very similar to quite a few recent video games. One I will, two I'll reference would be Hideo Kojima's Death Stranding, which is a walking simulator across a barren landscape. But then also The Last of Us, the Naughty Dog PlayStation game a couple of years ago, where it is just mainly long stretches of people talking while walking through desolate, locales. And that's what this has. It has set pieces that you get to. You get to an abandoned farmhouse, and it's like, is there somebody in there? What's going to happen? You have planes flying over in dogfighting. But then most of it is just these Tommies sharing stories with each other in between the moments of suspense. And that really is like a certain strand of video games right now, which I'd love to have played rather than have Sam Mendes playing it for me.
I think one of the other fascinating points about this film is that it's supposedly based partly on Sam Mendes' own grandfather's experience in the war, and which he kind of diarised. And it feels like doesn't feel like a very personal film. It's Sam Mendes, on the poster or whatever, but if you'd shown this to me and not told me who directed it, I probably wouldn't be able to tell you. And I think he isn't necessarily someone who does have... a signature style, but this doesn't feel like the work of someone who is putting a kind of really personal story on the screen. Mm-hmm. And that's not necessarily totally to the film's detriment, but I think when you're talking about, maybe less so nowadays, the First World War, but certainly the two wars, basically, they are invariably, they bring up very personal feelings and connections for people. Much like Peter Jackson's documentary did for a lot of people last year. And yeah, I mean, Dunkirk, I think, to a lesser extent, but still there was a lot of conversation around that. And one of the things I thought that was fascinating, the criticism around that, was the decision not to show the enemy. Mm-hmm. And I wish he'd kind of stuck with that. I think that would actually have made much more sense here than it does in Dunkirk.
What scores would you give this, Adam? In anticipation, enjoyment, in retrospect?
I was kind of intrigued. I think the fact that it came out of nowhere, that always instantly excites me when something is seemingly just been made quite surreptitiously and just dropped. So I'd say maybe a 4 for anticipation. And also just the idea of Sam Mendes doing anything other than a Bond film. But I'd say, yeah, probably a 3-3 for enjoyment and in retrospect. Hannah?
Yeah, I'm kind of the same. Maybe a 3 in anticipation, just because I'm not really a Mendes head, as I believe the fans are called. And then enjoyment in retrospect, 3. It's not a film I've really thought about much since I saw it. It hasn't really stayed with me. I will say, I mean, it looks fantastic. I think Deakins might be on for another Oscar after all these years.
I can agree with both of you. I think this is sort of 3s down the line for me. It is spectacular. It's really good to see on the big screen. But it's not... This film is racking up so many award nominations. Of course, you can't spell awards without war. And this sort of film is what gets big nominations. 9 BAFTAs this week. Got Best Drama, the Golden Globes.
The thing is, and we'll see in the coming weeks how it does in BAFTA and Oscar, but I think it's just a very uncontroversial film for them to give awards to. It's not Joker, which I think there will be a certain subset of the people who vote for these awards who will be like, well, I'm not voting, yeah, so comic book movie. Whereas 1917 is just a very like handsome looking prestige drama made by a director who has a lot of good faith and goodwill towards him. So I can understand why it's getting the awards. I just don't think it should be.
Okay.
I suspect it will get a lot of technical awards and possibly lose out on the big ones, but
I think it's deserving of the technical awards. I do think it is a good, solid bit of filmmaking.
That's
we'll
your
see.
Poster quote from Hannah Woodhead. Good, solid filmmaking.
Competent job all round.
For 1917. If you do go and see that film this week, let us know what you make of it at the usual channels, at Truth and Movies on Twitter, truthandmovies@tcolondon.com via email, or at the comments section at lwlies.com/podcast. Up next, we're moving on to the Second World War for Taika Waititi's Jojo Rabbit. Writer-director Taika Waititi brings his signature style to this Second World War comedy. Jojo, a young German lad and a keen member of the Hitler Youth in the waning days of the war, has his worldview turned upside down when he discovers his mother is hiding a young Jewish girl in their attic. Aided only by his idiotic imaginary friend, Adolf Hitler, played by Taika Waititi himself, Jojo must face some tough questions about his beliefs and his country. Let's hear a clip.
10-year-olds shouldn't be celebrating war and talking politics.
Hello, Hitler. I wish more of our young boys had your blind fanaticism.
Did you know Jews can read each other's minds?
But how would you know if you saw one? They could look just like us.
Hi.
You know what I am?
Say it. A Jew.
Sheesh, that was intense.
What am I going to do?
No idea.
Got it. I was negotiating.
Burn down the house and blame Winston Churchill. We'll negotiate.
The trailer for Jojo Rabbit there. So, Hannah, you saw this at Toronto last year, where there was quite a lot of excitement about this film, because Taika Waititi, after Thor and so on, is quite hot right now.
Yeah, he seems to have been attached to every project going since Thor Ragnarok came out in 2017?
I feel it's a long time in movies,
so,
isn't it?
So, no one can accuse Taika of not being hardworking. And this has been a passion project of his for many years. I remember hearing about this years ago. I think it was on the blacklist in 2012, 2011. So it's been knocking around Hollywood for quite a long time. I think it was just a case of him getting a bit of a higher profile in order to make it. And obviously, after making Ragnarok, he'd kind of got a lot of studio goodwill. And so he assembled this big old Hollywood cast to do this anti-hate satire, as they're calling it. And there was a whole thing after the Fox-Disney merger. There was a lot of news stories that came out about this film and kind of the conflict, I guess, between Disney and Fox, because this is a Fox film, and apparently Disney were not super sure it would fit in with their audience. So I'm not entirely sure if this is the vision of Jojo Rabbit that was intended,
right?
But it's the vision we've got.
And what did we get?
Where do you start with Jojo Rabbit? So we have Roman Griffin Davis, mm-hmm. who's a young British actor, very charming 12-year-old, playing this very idealistic, fully paid-up member of the Hitler Youth. But he's also a bit of a coward, and that's where he gets his name, because he won't kill a rabbit, which apparently is a thing that they do in that they did in Nazi youth groups. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Strange nickname origin. And anyway, he discovers that his mother, Scarlett Johansson, is hiding a young Jewish girl in mm-hmm. the house, and he is kind of forced to confront his prejudice because he meets this young Jewish girl played by Thomasin McKenzie, who is a wonderful young actress. She was in Leave No Trace. And yeah, I guess I'm giving you the plot rundown here.
That's the plot, right? But there's so, because as with a lot of Taika Waititi films, there's a lot of business around the story, right?
Yeah.
So of course, the big, it's all over the posters. Taika Waititi is playing Hitler in this movie in a very comic caricatured, yeah. completely unrecognisable sense.
Right? Yeah, I think that was the kind of whole joke around the film, was that you have, Taika's a very prolific tweeter, and he said, I can't think of anything that's going to piss off Hitler, the ghost of Hitler, more than having a Maori Jew play him in a film. Which, you know, fair enough. I'm being very diplomatic about this because I do understand, you know, he is a person of colour and has Jewish parents, I think his mother's Jewish. So I don't want to, you know, kind of piss on his chips and say that he doesn't have a right to tell a story in the way he finds helpful and productive to him. But I do think this is one of the worst films I've seen in a very long time, and I hated it.
Can you get to the heart of that in the space of this podcast?
So there's a wonderful quote from another critic. I can't remember who it is exactly. They said that it doesn't satirise Nazism. It infantilises the Holocaust, which I think is totally... there is no better way of summing up this film. It reduces the systematic extermination of millions of Jewish people. And not only Jewish people, of course, you know, they were not the only victims of the Holocaust. It reduces it to this, like, oh, Hitler was a bit silly bit, which I think is just, like, abhorrent. I don't really think that Jojo Rabbit tries to satirise anything. There is even a scene in which it kind of tries to, like, redeem the Nazis and be like, oh, actually, there were some nice Nazis too, which is just a very strange thing to point out in 2019, 2020. It's we know, but the problem is that they were still Nazis, even though they were nice people. But yeah,
It does slot into that subgenre of Second World War films like The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas, Life is Beautiful, which takes a sort of juvenile, the view of a young child trying to process these horrors. Is it successful?
I'll tell you the problem with that here, and I've heard that argument a lot, that it is told from a child's perspective. The problem is not that. The problem is that everyone in the film behaves like a child.
Mm-hmm.
So the other Nazis that we see and spend a bit of time with, like Sam Rockwell and Rebel Wilson and Stephen Merchant, they're all behaving. It's a very, like, obviously cartoonish caricature of Nazism, but the stuff they do is just not really plausible. They're basically acting like total buffoons. They're acting like children playing dress up or something. Mm-hmm. And I think that just undermines any attempt at satire the film could attempt, because, you know, if you have essentially adults behaving childishly, even a 12-year-old boy, I don't think, would look at it and be like, oh yeah, that makes sense. Like, what they're doing is something that I could get behind. Doesn't really try and explore or understand his fanaticism and why he suddenly is so, you know, why, I guess why he's so devout in his belief in the Führer and, mm-hmm. and in what his country is doing, because he's seeing adults and he's seeing people who are, you know, essentially supposed to be guiding figures in his life behaving like people who have got an IQ that was below his, and the only adult that actually acts sensibly is his mother, and he doesn't really seem to pay much attention to her for some reason. And I think the big thing this film lacks ultimately is context.
Right.
So, you know, you can depict and quite easily satirise and lampoon Nazism, and Hitler is obviously a very easy target and has been widely ridiculed, and we'll come on to Charlie Chaplin later, but you can't really do that without providing some context as to what was actually going on and exploring, like, the root of what was happening in Nazi Germany at the time. And I think the thing that really sums this up for me So today is David Bowie's birthday as we're recording this, and his song Heroes plays at the end of this film, which I think just on a very superficial level is like, if you're using heroes at this point in time in your film, then you someone needs to have a word with you, because that is such a kind of passé, even like a cover or a foreign language version of it, that's such a sort of passé thing to do. But at the very start of the film, there's another song, a very famous pop song by a little-known band called The Beatles, playing over the opening credits of the film, and it's their German-language version of I Want to Hold Your Hand. Mm-hmm. And it's matched with archive footage of rallies and basically, like, rapturous Nazi crowds.
Lots of saluting going on.
Lots of saluting. And when I was watching this, I was kind of thinking, this is actually quite ingenious, like, drawing a comparison between Beatlemania and what was going on in Germany in the 1930s. And it's such a shame that he doesn't really explore that and, again, provide context to that. I think he just uses it as quite a cute opening refrain for the film to set the tone. And, you know, there's possibly a little bit of a suggestion of what we're going to expect from Jojo and his relationship with his imaginary friend character. But I think, it sets up this idea of how fanaticism, or what fanaticism looks like, basically, and then just doesn't really explore that.
Yeah, I think the lack of interrogation in this film, really, it all just feels a bit slapdash. The other thing that I've had many conversations about this film with my friends is that you never really know where it's meant to be set. Mm-hmm. And that's a very important thing about World War II. So it's set in the kind of dying days of the Second World War, and maybe it's somewhere in Germany, I think, is meant to be the point, mm-hmm. but it's very light on kind of where. Because at the end, we kind of see the end of the war, basically. And it's kind of... it really threw me... And maybe this is coming... I studied history at university, so maybe I'm coming at it from a very pedantic point of view. But it just all feels very sort of generalised and very baby's first history lesson. And I really think we're past that stage now. I think you can't talk about something as vile as the Nazi regime without kind of being a little bit serious. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I think it's just... It was so disappointing to me to watch this film, because I really thought if anyone could do this right, it would be Taika Waititi. I'm a big fan of his. I really like a lot of his work. But I'm not sure that the kind of cutesy, whimsical approach works for this kind of content.
It makes me look again at his other films, and I've liked all of his films to date. And, you know, full disclosure, when I have been programming screenings in the past, I helped figure out the right situation around what he considers his proper debut, Boy, after Eagle vs. Shark. We put the first screenings on in the UK for many years here, and I think that this film shares some DNA with Boy and with Hunt for the Wilder People, the films where he has created these great young boy protagonists, but it shares the very silly comedy of something like What We Do in the Shadows, where it can't take anything seriously for a second until there is a moment in the film, which we've not touched on, where it does try and bid for a sentimental, emotional point. And it doesn't feel earned. It doesn't feel like it's taken itself very seriously. And it makes me think that he's actually not a very graceful or consistent or thoughtful filmmaker. And it's quite a shame to make that realisation six films into a
career. That moment as well, I think it does feel quite shocking in the context of the film. Because up until that point, everything has been very cutesy and whimsical and ho, 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 aren't the Nazis funny? But then after that, it's kind of just life goes on. Mm-hmm. And I mean, when people see the film, they'll realise how kind of implausible that is. But yeah, I mean, it's just, what a cast to be so kind of wasted. I don't think there's any... Well, maybe Thomasine McKenzie, but I think it's kind of a thankless role she has. But Sam Rockwell, I found incredibly grating. I think the one person, the one Nazi, who kind of I thought really could have brought this home was Stephen Merchant, because I think he really has this very creepy kind of Indiana Jones and the Ark of the Covenant vibe to him in this. But that's the thing, like, I think there were times when it really could have gone away from this cutesiness and taken us down a darker path, and it would have made it more kind of interesting. I really do just think it's such a sad waste of a film.
Yeah, I will note, before we go to the scores, this has been... there's always one. Green Book was last year, Three Billboards Outside of Missouri the year before. There's always a film that everyone seems divided on between critics on the original initial screenings versus critics on wider screenings, then the public see it, and then Oscars and awards come out. And this seems to be the one that people are disagreeing on quite strongly this year. And so opinions may vary, and if listeners have seen this film and love it, please let us know what you make of it. But let's get the scores. Hannah, I'll come to you first for the three scores.
So I was probably at a 4 in anticipation. I genuinely thought this could be quite good. Was a little bit apprehensive after the first trailer dropped. But then, yeah, so then went in at Toronto, had the benefit, I think, of coming to it before the discourse. And it was like a 1-1. I really, really could not jive with this. And it made me quite angry because I think Taika is a really great filmmaker and clearly a very intelligent man, and I just can't understand what drove him to make this film at all.
Adam?
Well, I'm not a huge fan of his stuff generally. I think I quite liked Hunt for the Wilder People, actually saying that, but I think his particular mode of humour isn't really my thing. And actually, if you have enjoyed his previous films, you may well just like it on that level, because, you know, it is very much the same kind of humour that he's delivering here. But I'd say probably a 2 in anticipation. And just, yeah, from everything you'd said about it, Hannah, everything I'd seen, it has that air of like a 1 for me kind of film, when a director, as you say, has success with a major studio feature and then is basically given carte blanche to do something like this, and that they rarely turn out successfully. And I'd have to say 2 in enjoyment and a 1 in retrospect. I don't think it's a film that I don't think it's a film that I would want to watch again, but I just don't also think it's a film that will live long in the memory for a lot of people, and will probably be spoken about, and there'll be like academia written about it, but not in a good sense.
I'd say 4-2-2 for me. He's one of my favourite filmmakers, but this one just didn't really work for me, and I'd take this opportunity to recommend Boy so strongly. That's a film where he brings, I mean, it's very similar to Jojo Rabbit. Taika Waititi plays a father figure that is an outsized character that comes into the life of this boy. It's his father in that case. But it's a study of identity and community, and it's, yeah.
This
strikes
the thing,
that
though,
balance so well.
If you want to make a film about war from a child's perspective and about fanaticism and how people, not just young people, but people can be indoctrinated, just set it in any other period of history or around any kind of fictitious war. Don't make it about the Nazis.
Anyway, that is Jojo Rabbit. Let us know what you make of it at the usual channels. Up next, Film Club. We're sticking with the Second World War for another satire. This time from Charlie Chaplin, it's The Great Dictator.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Released in 1940, The Great Dictator saw Charlie Chaplin using his comic genius to skewer the Third Reich as war broke out across Europe. Using his on-screen resemblance to Hitler to full effect, Chaplin plays a dual role of both the fascist dictator Adenoid Hinkle and a Trumper-like Jewish barber who faces anti-Semitic persecution under Hinkle's tyrannical regime. Let's hear a clip from the vintage trailer.
It's Adenoid Hinkle, the Fui of Tomania.
Captain!
I bet you recognize him too. It's Charlie, the wonderful, the extraordinary Charlie Chaplin. By a strange trick of fate, the ruthless dictator and Charlie resemble each other like two peas in a pod. Except that while Adenoid Hinkle makes millions of people tremble, Charlie makes them die of laughter.
I love hearing these old trailers.
That Charlie makes them die of laughter. So good.
Adam, did you die watching this film?
Well, yes, I did. Obviously not literally, because I'm here speaking to you. The reason I wanted to pick this, actually, I think there are possibly better World War II satires and ones which have held up from the period. I think To Be or Not to Be is a really shining example of that. But I just kind of wanted to see how this held up now, mm-hmm. Not just in the context of Jojo Rabbit, but just with the kind of everything that's kind of going on in the world. And, you know, to provide a bit of context to this, it was written actually as Hitler was coming to power. And I think Chaplin had sort of famously said that had he known the full extent of the Nazis' atrocities and what was going on, he probably wouldn't have made this film, or at least he wouldn't have made it in the way that he did. Which I think, you know, with hindsight, is a pretty bold thing and brave thing to say as a filmmaker. But it just shows that context is everything in this situation, this scenario. And crucially, I think what he's doing here and why this works so well as a satire is, you know, he's really going after the head figure of this regime. And, you know, again, even at the time, it was very easy to ridicule Hitler. And I think Chaplin, especially, as someone who Hitler famously borrowed his own look partly on, you know, based it on Chaplin, and was a big fan. And a Chaplin, I think the film was banned in Nazi Germany, obviously, and wasn't shown for many years across kind of not, you know, post-war as well. And Chaplin always said he'd been fascinated to know what Hitler had made of it, and I'm sure he would have watched it just out of curiosity. And someone who is that much of a sort of narcissist and egotist would definitely have given it a whirl. But yeah, I think the reason it works fundamentally is because the humour is, I guess it's a lot more like you always know who you're supposed to be laughing at and what side, not only Charlie Chaplin's character, and I think this is the brilliance of having the dual role, because you have that contrast between the guy who's being persecuted and the guy that's essentially responsible for it. But yeah, I think you always know where you are with it. You always know like who you're supposed to be laughing with and at. And I think that's something Jojo Rabbit doesn't quite understand and get right, just to go back to that. But do you know what? Even just on a basic comedic level, I think as one of his first, I think it's his first full sound and full dialogue movie, moving away from the silent era. And there are moments early on where the soundtrack or the sound design of the movie actually cuts out, and there are just like slapstick moments played out in silence, which is almost like him acknowledging that he's in this transition. And but I think the moments that just stand out for me still are the little slapstick touches that he throws in, like the bit where he, as Hinkle, when he's in his office and he shimmies up the curtain. It just gets me every time. Mm-hmm. It's like, I think the first time I saw that, I was just crying laughing watching that. And yeah, there's just so many small moments, I think. And the scene around the dinner table, that's like classic Chaplin, I think, just on a satire and just a basic slapstick comedic level. I think this film really holds up.
It's really fascinating watching this film alongside the two films we just watched, because it does have a First World War sequence at the beginning. Mm. In fact, that opening sequence, The Great Dictator, is almost a parody of 1917, because it's like looking at the First World War with the visual wit of someone like Charlie Chaplin. And some of my favourite bits are in that sequence where he gets in the flak gun and he's just like constantly wheeling around and going upside down, bang forward. It's a person looking at war and trying to see what is visually absurd about it. But then the naivety, or maybe the straightness of the satire, doesn't come from the depoliticized or the ignorance of the other two films, like leaving out the context. It's the fact that he didn't have the full context, which is so fascinating. So he can just look at the plain visual ridiculousness of these characters. I don't think the bit that doesn't age very well for me at all is I don't find making fun of how other languages sound. You know,
oh, the like German gibberish that he
and
speaks.
Italian gibberish, where it's just, where the Mussolini standing comes in and he's just like, ah, pizza, cannoli, ravioli.
Yeah, that's very of the time, I think, right? But I think, you know, it wasn't just Chaplin doing that.
Of course,
you know,
not.
You look back at kind of shows from like the British sitcoms from the 70s that were doing a similar thing, and definitely hasn't aged particularly well.
But even in Jojo Rabbit, they make a joke. But that when Hitler is talking to Jojo and he says, "Do you even speak German?" and like he just is like screaming Heil Hitler over and over again. Mm-hmm. It hasn't aged well, but I do get it. It's a very hard language to learn as well.
But I do love how this film at times just looks like a political cartoon come to life, and it has the you know, as I said, the visual wit, but also that this pointed nature when there's the ballet with the inflatable balloon globe, which gets to the heart of, you know, the totalitarian madness, but also how he sees himself as this graceful balletic figure whilst also being an absolute imbecile.
The scene that I really love is when he's stripping the... Is it one of his generals of all his medals?
Yeah. He's just like, and he starts taking buttons off and
undoes his shirt. He's just like, no. It's, you know, just they don't make them like they used to, do they?
How does the sentimental ending? This is something that, you know, Charlie Chaplin, compared to all the great silent comedians, is always charged as being the great sentimentalist, and his final monologue here is seen as almost his most sentimental moment. How does that work?
Well, I think watching that today, it stands up because of how much what he's saying rings true today. I think it almost like torpedoes the film because it's such an obvious like breaking the fourth wall moment. Like he isn't the tramp or the Jewish barber or Hinkle anymore. It's just Charlie Chaplin, and he's speaking basically directly to the audience. But you know, it's a sort of gambit that paid off massively at the time. It was his biggest box office success, and I mean when this came out, remember that the US was still officially, you know, not part of the Allied movement and was very much like not involved in the war really. And you know, I think they were, especially the US government, were a little bit wary of you know, criticizing and satirizing Hitler. And but Chaplin was this huge movie star, and he had the money first and foremost, but he was able to get a film like this made, and it just showed how, I think history has shown how right he was. Basically,
it must have been absolutely exhilarating to be a film goer in that day and age, and have that happen at the end, where Charlie Chaplin, a person you have a relationship with for many decades by that point,
and haven't heard him speak
and
properly.
Speaks at great length right at you. It must have been chilling to see. I must say, where does this rank for you in Charlie Chaplin movies?
I don't actually think it's one of his best. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of what we're talking about here, you know, it holds up on its own terms. But if you're talking about, I mean, he made so many great movies. I still think Modern Times is probably my favourite still. But yeah, he made so many amazing movies. But I think certainly that, if you just take that monologue at the end on its own, and I'm sure you can just watch the whole thing on YouTube or wherever. Mm-hmm. But obviously, I would implore people to go out and watch the whole film. You can, but you can kind of annex it from the film in a way, and it does hold up on its own and really resonates. And you know, I think it's also coloured slightly by the knowledge of sort of what happened to Chaplin after this, because you know he wasn't someone who was necessarily persecuted by external forces. He was someone who's persecuted by his own country, and you know, essentially exiled to Switzerland. And you know, I think he was. There was a lot of talk at the time about, you know, him being a communist potentially, and the House and American Committee were like after him. And he basically, you know, went and lived the rest of his life in isolation from the US. And it's sort of really sad watching this film now in the knowledge of that. And you know, if only they had kind of actually taken on board what he was saying and the message he was trying to get across.
It is a fascinating turning point in his career, because he never really is this massive titanic figure again. This is why I probably preferred the two films he made before and after. So you have the films he made during the Sound period where he was resisting the coming of the talkies with City Lights and Modern Times, and then the two after The Great Dictator, where he makes Monsieur Verdoux, which is his almost like darkening of the Charlie Chaplin mythos, and Limelight, which is him looking back to his days on the stage. But these are films that he's making in exile. Mm. I mean, in exile in a nice cushy mansion on a lake in Switzerland, yeah. But he was never allowed to go back.
Sort of self-imposed exile to a point, but essentially it was very difficult for him to continue making films in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even someone with his clout and financial backing.
Well, if we agree with Ricky Gervais, no, none of these film stars can tell us anything because they're all complicit in the Hollywood system, right? But anyway, 80th anniversary this year.
Yeah.
Maybe we should go and rewatch that.
Yeah, I'd highly recommend.
Anyway, that is The Great Dictator. Please do let us know what you think if you watch that, or if you watch any other Charlie Chaplin films, go further down the rabbit hole. There's so many good movies and shorts as well to find there. Next week, as Hannah teased, we have A Hidden Life, the latest film from Terrence Malick. We have Bombshell, another awards contender. And for Film Club, because we're doing Terrence Malick, we're going to go back to his second feature, 1978's Days of Heaven. Let us know what you think of Days of Heaven if you've seen that, or if you're catching up with it for the first time at the usual channels. That's Truth and Movies on Twitter, truthandmovies@tcolondon.com via email, or at the comments section at lwlies.com/podcast. Until then, Hannah, Adam, thank you so much for joining me this week. I'm Mike Leader, and as always, this has been a 7 Digital production.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.